have 3 hours. They've got to go through all four game plots. 3 hours or less, and they're going to need every second, because you know who's on their tail?
The
Stars! Who?
The Stars!
And you know what happens then?
Anything goes!
What?
Anything goes!
All right, without further ado, it's time to start running!
Welcome to this review of The Running Man, part of the Percolated Media Stephen King Retrospective Series.
I'm going to give the audience what I think they want.
Join Garrett.
That boy's one mean motherfucker.
Matt.
You look pissed, Ben.
And Adam.
You believe this shit?
As they review this adaptation of King's apocalyptic novel.
Guess they want us to stay.
And keep coming back, podcast listeners, as a Three Men in a Retrospective podcast will continue going through the popular novelist's cinematic adaptations in publication order.
Come on, get me out of here, you guys!
This is not a rerun.
What a colossal fight!
The Percolated Media review of The Running Man begins now!
It's showtime!
The Running Man, 2025. This was released November 5th, 2025. Budget on this was $110 million. Box office, $68.6 million. Ouch! And this is directed by Edgar Wright. Wow, Edgar Wright. Matt, am I right in assuming that in the going on 12 years we've been doing this together, this is our first Edgar Wright picture?
Well, I'm going to skip past the obvious play on words since you asked if this was a Wright decision. Yes, we had talked about doing it at the old place, but we just never found the right avenue or tie-in to make it work. Because we had talked about it initially as just being like a filler retro in between, but we're like, no, we want to tie something into actually something that's coming out. And it took him, you know, basically 5 years from Baby Driver to Soho. And in that time frame, you know, we started this production here. So the stars never aligned.
Well, they're aligned now, and my goodness, a Stephen King adaptation by Edgar Wright, that's something I never thought I would hear.
Yeah, especially after, the guy who left a Marvel production over a lack of creative control, going to an author who, more often than not, I don't want to say he intervenes or meddles, but he's always very vocal and involved to a variety of extents when he does these productions.
And he was involved in this one as well.
Yeah, and coming from a director, though, who, outside of Scott Pilgrim, which is the outlier, all of his movies are distinctively original.
Before I get to our feelings on Edgar Wright as a whole, I did want to mention that I know we ended last week's show by saying, well, we're going to be doing Scream this week. I wanted to put this one in because it is part of our King retrospective. So we had four King adaptations last year. This one, we covered the original of this last year around this time. Adam, were you excited when you heard that we were going to get another Running Man?
I was excited when I first heard about it because I thought that it was the type of movie that could definitely benefit from an update, either in the same vein or changing and keeping to the original tone. I was very excited when I saw who came on board. Glenn Powell, I think he's fine, you know, as an actor, but I was like, okay, I'm looking forward to see what he could do. I'm a big fan of Edgar Wright, and I was very excited to see what he could do, especially after something like Last Night in Soho. You know, I feel like he could bring the dark that this needed. So I was excited until the first trailer came out, and that completely sapped my energy for looking forward to this.
Now, you have just mentioned it, but you are a fan of Edgar Wright, huh? You liked Last Night in Soho, you like the Blood and Ice Cream trilogy, you like all that.
I've never seen the Blood and Ice Cream trilogy.
Really? Oh, shit.
And I know that is just, I know people are like screaming at me right now, love you, Nate, but I haven't got around to it because I just heard about it so much, but I adore Baby Driver, the issue in that movie notwithstanding. Like, I adore that film so much. Last Night in Soho, less so, because I see the issues with it, but it's such a ballsy kind of move that nobody makes. So I just love the auteur spirit that he still brings to filmmaking, because I don't think there's enough of it. And Scott Pilgrim is just still so fucking fun decades later.
That is a fun film. Now, Matt, we've kind of gotten your feelings, but you're a pretty big Edgar Wright fan too, right? Although probably not as much as Adam is.
No, I actually am, but from the opposite perspective, because the Cornetto trilogy was my introduction. I saw Shaun of the Dead second. Hot Fuzz was the first movie that I saw. And I saw it at a time where I didn't fully understand that it was a homage, a parody, and a tribute all in one. I kind of just looked at it as a straightforward action comedy. And then I realized, oh, you should see his previous movie where it's a real horror comedy. And then eventually I saw all the subsequent work. Unlike Adam, I really liked Baby Driver when I first saw it, but Adam's had issue. That cast list has more issues on it than your local comic book store. So in a lot of ways, it's really tainted my overall enjoyment. And I did not like Last Night in Soho, but I will also admit part of that is because I am not a fan in large of the films, the horror films that he was paying homage to in that. So I did have sort of a preconceived bias when that was coming out. But that notwithstanding, I thought it was a well-made movie. So I was excited that he was going to be doing another adaptation because I thought Scott Pilgrim was a great both adaptation as well as putting the film medium in the adaptation aspect, which a lot of people miss. Zack Snyder being a big one with Watchmen, which we'll talk about. So I was excited for this, but like Adam, the trailers for this, I got less and less anticipatory with every one that I kept seeing in basically every movie that went in front of me, which is amazing because the amount of trailers I saw in the theater, I think there were more trailers than people who went to go see the movie at the theaters.
You're not a fan of giallo, huh?
Well, it depends. I don't like Argento, and he's kind of like one of the main people you associate with giallo. There's some Mario Bava I like, but it's not my particular horror sensibility.
Interesting. I remember my line that year being that I felt like James Wan, who did Malignant that year, did giallo better than Edgar Wright did with Last Night in Soho.
You're not wrong.
Yeah. No, he did.
Maybe we'll get to those one day. Oh, man. Yeah, I was super excited for this, actually. Obviously, me being the King fan. I thought, and we talked about this when we did Running Man last year, I thought that could definitely use an update. Although, in watching it, Adam, you know, we mentioned that was out a couple years before American Gladiators, that kind of started Survivor, that kind of started a whole thing of reality TV that we're still seeing the remnants of to this day.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling in the build up to this and when it was coming out was, what can they do to update this? And thinking that, is there a way they can make it so that it's as viable and as forward thinking as that first film felt? Adam, did you think that? Like, is there a place they can take this?
I did, especially since they just only a few months before. And look, I believe they're different studios, but I think it was a really bad time to release it so close to The Long Walk, because that's a movie that feels tempered with today's sensibility. And while this tries to go a different direction, the politics of now always have to be part of The Running Man, or at least the politics of the near future. And it's hard to escape that. And how are you going to do it? You're either going to alienate the people that want the fun, you're going to make it dark and dreary, which The Long Walk was, but still found a different way to tell it. So I did think that there was a tightrope that just this thing was going to have a hard time with, because that first one is such cheesy classic fun. It would be trying to, I don't know, let's say remake Predator and doing that 5 or 6 times and trying to see if you could finally catch lightning in a bottle, for example.
For a recent example, go back to our retrospective. Matt, what's your feelings on that, man? Did you think there was a way they could update this?
Oh, absolutely. But I always knew that of the movies of Stephen King that were going to get remakes, I thought this one made a lot of logical sense, because I sort of looked at it the same way I looked at the, speaking of Schwarzenegger, when they said, oh, we're going to remake Total Recall. And I was like, okay, both Total Recall and Running Man are Schwarzenegger vehicles first, and then Stephen King kind of took a backseat, which is why he didn't care for the Running Man, and a lot of the Philip K. Dick aspects of Total Recall are there, but it's Schwarzenegger and Verhoeven kind of overshadowing the written text. So the idea of doing another version, I just looked at this as another take on the material, which Wright was very vocal about saying this is not going to be just remaking the Schwarzenegger movie. And he was someone that I fully believe when he said that. I didn't think he was trying to bury the lead, so to speak. But the problem, at least that I saw, and Adam touched on this as well, the original film very much, and we talked about this in our review, was the precursor to a lot of what would happen with reality television. It was very predictive in that way. Nowadays, reality TV, as we know it, I don't want to say it's gone away, but it's been kind of put in the back seat because of things like YouTube and vlogs and TikTok, that the television medium and like people watching, you know, network syndicated shows. Those days are basically all but over, especially with the fact that every freaking cable company or provider you have has some kind of streaming app you have to pay for. So I wondered how they were going to change like the viewing experience. And part of it is also, I think the Hunger Games has kind of taken a lot of the aspects and done it in a, you know, the dystopian future, the game show aspect, the flamboyant personalities, the, you know, the economic hardship, that I felt like this was kind of a step too late, speaking of running, and a step behind what had already been done. I feel like there have been better versions of the actual Running Man premise, that this, I was worried, was going to be kind of outdated by the time it actually came out.
Yeah, you look at Squid Game too. You know, that kind of took...
Yeah, that's a big one.
That's a big one.
You hit what I was going to say. The phenomenon of Squid Game only being 4 years ago, I think, saps so much energy.
Yeah, but you know what? They did just do a 35th season of Survivor. And Matt, you and I just saw a movie in the last couple of weeks that plays off of Survivor. Yes. Talking
and
about
also,
Send Help.
Survivor celebrating its 50th season.
Yeah.
In a couple of weeks. So that, outside of your mainstays like Survivor, American Idol, a lot of reality television has just become, it happens for a season and that's it. They don't have the longevity that, and like I said, I just think this premise is kind of, and the short story, other people have taken aspects and reinterpreted them to make them feel distinctive, that, like I said, I was worried this was going to be very outdated. And I'm just so tired of people saying, you know, we're making a movie of the dystopian future when we're kind of living it in present day.
Yeah, there have been attempts to remake this over the years. I don't know if you guys remember. Adam, do you remember when Ben Affleck and Matt Damon were going to do a show that kind of played off the Running Man concept?
I think it was part of their, when they first got their own company. It wasn't through the green, but it was that side production company they were going with.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was before they did their Project Greenlight thing. They tried putting the show together where, yeah, people were out in the country, and if you were a citizen who spotted them and you took a picture, you could get some money. They just couldn't find a way to do it where people were actually fully protected, so they put those plans away pretty quick. So this movie came about in a very strange way, in that it was put on the back burner for a while. You know, they were like, okay, well, we have Survivor, we have all these reality TV shows. Running Man's not really made to be remade right now. In 2017, this movie came about from Twitter, of all things, where Edgar Wright was asked a question by a fan. He said, of all the movies out there, what is one that you want to remake the most? And Edgar Wright mentioned he wants to do a new version of The Running Man. And Matt, our buddy, Simon Kinberg, saw this tweet, and he talked to Edgar Wright about maybe doing this, and him and Michael Bacall, his longtime collaborator, put together a script. You know what? I didn't believe that we were going to see it. As you guys know, I listened to quite a few Stephen King podcasts, and they were mentioning the development of this, but it wasn't until Michael Bacall was interviewed on one that I listened to, and he mentioned that he had the script in front of him right there that has just been greenlit. And that's when I was like, oh shit, I'm getting excited for this. And this was like 2020. And Stephen King, if you guys notice, his name is on this as an executive producer. He did have full approval of the script. He had full approval of the cast. And Edgar Wright did say that when he mentioned Glenn Powell as a lead, Stephen King wasn't too familiar with his work, so Edgar Wright gave him Hitman to watch. And Edgar Wright mentioned this to Glenn Powell, and Glenn Powell said it was the longest night of his life having Stephen King watch this and actually being able to approve whether or not he's in the movie, because his whole future in this movie was based on that viewing. Stephen King liked it, liked Powell, gave his approval. And in February 2021, it was announced that they are actually doing it. Before Glenn Powell, though, Matt, how would you have felt with Chris Evans in the lead role here?
He would have been too distracting to be the everyman type of guy, because I have a problem on principle with doing the running man from the perspective of, you know, you're an average guy when you're casting guys who are basically on the cover of People magazine and Sexiest Man Alive. I know that's kind of a... It's a business decision also, because you got to get people who can attract butts and seats. I'm not going to say it would have been better or worse, because I'll talk about Powell in the movie itself, but I think that would have been too... look, we got freaking... You would have had Captain America, Thanos, Ronan the Accuser. There's a lot of Marvel alumni in this as it is. So maybe that would have played, but I think he's not... Chris Evans is not believable anymore as an average guy.
Adam, how do you feel about that?
I would have liked it 10 years ago. It would be hard to pull off now. I think Chris Evans could do it, but I think Matt's exactly right.
Okay, so as I mentioned, this movie comes out. It is not a huge financial success. And when I went and saw this, opening weekend. I was super excited for this. And obviously, my lovely fiance was not. So she's like, yep, you go. You enjoy. And so this was a solo outing. And it was probably about a half full theater. Adam, how did you see this initially?
I actually did not get a chance to see this till it was a stream at home. I missed it theatrically because I didn't see it in the 3 weeks that it was in theaters. So I caught it as soon as it was. I regret not seeing it. I really wanted to. I tried, but life lifed me those couple weeks. But it was at home. Took the time to pay attention to watch it. And I was looking forward. By the time this movie came out, I had warmed back up to it. I said the trailers had let me down. I think the marketing for this thing was just abysmal. But at the end of the day, I did think there was a good story to be told, and I thought they put together good people to do it. So I was excited to sit and watch it.
Matt, what about you? You saw it in theaters too, right?
Yes, I did. And when I say I saw it in the theater, I saw it in a theater all by my lonesome. There was nobody else there. This was maybe...
private screening.
About a week after it came out, well, I saw it with a friend. So I
okay.
So felt bad for the poor bastards who had to clean the theater just for our two asses. But I do think the marketing really hurt this in a lot of ways, because I don't think the trailers were particularly good. Glenn Powell's not a draw to the masses to the level that, like, I haven't seen Hollywood try to push a guy like this since freaking Charlie Hunnam. It's kind of, it's the guy from John Carter, Taylor Kitsch.
Oh yeah,
they tried a lot with him. Like it feels to that degree where they desperately want this guy to be a leading man, kind of like the next Brad Pitt. I think is what they want him to be, because, you know, good looking guy, brownish hair, jawline.
Well, he is trying to pattern himself after Tom Cruise. In fact, him and Tom Cruise had a conversation in the lead up to this, and Tom Cruise said, "You're going to be in The Running Man. You better learn how to run." So I guess Tom Cruise did teach him a few tricks on how to run on screen, which I found interesting.
I feel like Tom Cruise is trying to bring Glenn Powell along the way that he used to try to bring Will Smith along. That he's just like, I don't know. They may be sharing some of that feet and blood in some private meeting somewhere, but man, there is a creepy connection with those two.
One more thing before I get to the actual film. I do want to mention that in the time since this was in theaters and us recording this, which is the beginning of February, I actually did reread the book this movie is based on. And you know what, guys? I got to say, without getting into my thoughts on the film, when Edgar Wright said he was going to do a direct adaptation of that book, that's what he does. There is not too many scenes of this that are not from that book. And so I found that interesting in rereading it, and that, right, he decided to update a few things, but most of it's kind of word for word. But, all right, do you guys have anything else to say before I dig into this film here?
You're running.
All right, so we open up, we got the Paramount logo. As we go to our star, Glenn Powell, telling the camera and his boss that he's not angry. He begs to be taken off the blacklist. He needs to work, and his daughter, who's with him, is sick. This was an unusual way to start things. And, all right, let's talk about Glenn Powell right off the bat. Like Matt, I kind of feel like this guy's kind of been shoved in our faces for the last couple years. I like him in this role for the most part. My problem with him is I feel like the whole anger aspect of the character is too manufactured for me. I don't believe this guy when he loses his temper. Matt, what do you feel about Glenn Powell here?
I think manufactured is the appropriate word because I feel like Powell understands this character better than the script does. And as a result, I find his whole characterization to be very one note. And I could not believe how simplistically defined his plight is with the losing his job and the sick kid. At first, I thought this was setting up to be in the same way that his Cornetto trilogy is a send-up of, you know, all the stuff that he loves. I thought this was going to be a satire of those, like, a certain type of action movie where it's, you know, doing crazy things with good intentions, because this feels right out of, like, the playbook of likable protagonist. He's got an issue, personally. He's got a sick kid, you know, lives in a hellhole of a society. And again, I just think it's too, for a movie that's way too long, and I'm going to be up front right now and say that, I wish more time is spent to the characterization and setting him up than the movie allows him to make. Because, you know, the Schwarzenegger movie, within the first, like, what, 15, 20 minutes, he's getting worked up into the whole Running Man. But you learn everything about that guy in that whole opening sequence between the prison and the helicopter incident. And I feel like I understand that Ben Richards far more than I understand this one, with less screen time and a dumber movie, which is a huge problem I have. As far as Powell himself, I think he's okay. Can't call him miscast, but I don't see him as an everyman. And that's a huge problem I have.
Well, the reason why Schwarzenegger was so easy to understand is because there are less layers to that character. But in this case, I'm with you in that I think less was more. Because the reason why I understand Schwarzenegger is because I don't know about his wife. I don't know about his son or daughter. I don't know about any of that, but I understand where he's coming from. With Powell, I feel he's angry, and I feel like he's about ready to lose his job, but I don't really care.
One last thing I want to say, the whole anger thing, that gets old really quick.
Very.
And his, it feels almost like, I kept expecting him to say that he wouldn't like me when I'm angry. Because yeah. it's so one note. And that's really the only one they consistently give him for the first, like, quarter to third of this movie.
I'm going to be the one to say I like the choice of having somebody like him do this instead of somebody like Arnold. I do. Maybe it's because I look just like him that, you know, I see myself. No. I do like this type of choice, the way that the character is. I like the darkness that this brings. And starting it off this way, I think it gets a little whiplash with his, you know, going to anger and cutting back and all. I mean, it's, I agree that way, but I feel that that's leading into the way that Wright likes to edit and wet pan cameras even sometimes and shit. I just think that's his way of doing it. The more that this goes in, as much as I think it could be, you know, written a little cleaner, I think it's a good choice. I think it's a good change from Arnold to go with this type of person instead of a wrestler Hulk Hogan style person. I think this is the right move to take for this update.
See, I agree with that point, that I'm happy this isn't a Schwarzenegger, or, like, you know, there's a world where this would have been made with Dave Bautista. I could have seen that, which I'm sure would have worked and would have been great for that type of movie. But again, when you have a guy whose abs look like I could cut bread on them, I can't sympathize with you too much as an average guy that I can find down the street. And I'm not saying I want Paul Giamatti to be the leading man, because that would not be believable either.
You have Michael Cera in here.
Actually, that might have been interesting. But I was expecting, you know, someone a little bit more rugged, or like a Joe Schmo. It's the whole thing of, like, what if Richard Dreyfuss was in Total Recall? That whole type of paradox.
So Ben's starting to lose his temper, and he says, "You won't like me when I'm angry." Oh, wait, no, that's for a month. Stay tuned, guys. We'll get to this. We'll get to those films here pretty soon. And he's escorted out. We're hearing and seeing advertisements for The Running Man with Josh Brolin as the host here.
Well, no.
Oh, not as the host, as the producer, but he is front and center in the advertisements, is what I'm saying.
And this is a question for you as someone who's read the book. Uh-huh. So in the original movie, they basically compartmentalized Brolin and Domingo into one character with Richard Dawson.
They did.
You know, he's both the host and the producer. In the book, are they two separate characters?
Two separate characters. And I will agree with the choice of the 1987 movie more than I'll agree with this choice. I agree with the idea of combining the two characters. Although I will say, I do think the host they get later, which we'll talk about, is great. I like the fact that it was just one sleazy guy behind all of it more than I like what they do here. All right, I want to go ahead and say right out of the gate, guys. Josh Brolin is one of my favorite parts of this film. I find his teeth distracting, but in a funny way.
Well, he's got the Tom Cruise perfect smile.
Yes.
Maybe that was an in-joke.
Yes, I believe so, too. How do we feel about Josh Brolin here?
I think he does a good job. I could have used him doing both, as much as I love the person we're going to get here in a little bit. So I could use a little more of him. But he's restrained, but still has that malevolence to him, which I enjoy. It almost feels like he was picked last minute to put in here, though, because you could eliminate this character and not change much. You can combine the two characters and maybe gain something. So almost like in Weapons, it's like, was he planned here from the beginning? Because it doesn't feel like it. But I like seeing Josh Brolin when he's doing something almost as a side character. And he's good here. He fills out the world without being distracting.
So in retrospect, if this was made 10 years ago, I think he would have been the perfect lead.
Yeah.
Good point. Now, having said that, I think I have the same problem with him, more so the writing. I think he does a good job with the performance. But it reminds me a lot of when they got Bryan Cranston, the Total Recall remake, where he's too over the top for the rest of the movie. And it's not that degree here. But I also feel like they wrote this character for one scene just to set up just to entice him to get on the show. And they're like, oh, we have Josh Brolin for some extra days, so let's beef up his role. Like, I feel like this role should have been played by Simon Pegg or one of Wright's actual, like, you know, collaborators, you know, like Nick Frost, Patty Considine, take your pick, as like a wink and a nod cameo for Wright. And then the host takes over the reins. But like I said, I feel like because they got Brolin, They beefed up his role, not unnecessarily because I like seeing him, but it does feel a bit of a detraction because I think it overextends the runtime. Runtime.
Ben makes it home as we zoom in close on a picture of his wife and daughter, and he's making up his daughter's meds. You know what? I have to say, this is very close to the book, except in the book, his wife is actually working the streets, as they say. She is a hooker in the book and not just a cocktail waitress. So they adhere pretty close to that. Adam, as a huge fan of Sinners, you must have liked seeing this woman in this movie, right?
I did. And I do think that they played the part of at least alluding to her being a hooker in the books. I feel like that's there, you know, in the for those that have read the book like you. I like this. I kind of want more of this darkness to it. I know the movie would not be nearly as marketable as what they were hoping for. You know, they're looking for more of a summer blockbustery type, but man, you give me a dark movie with these themes, and this is more what I want of this. And I like it. I think the performances are good when you get this kind of dark drama.
Well, they had a choice to go dark, but we'll get there when we get there. So more Running Man is shown on the TV as Ben is one of these armchair players who gets all the answers correct while watching it. And then we're seeing some sap falling off the treadmill that he's on as the question is being asked, and he lands face first as his wife Sheila comes home with a fake version of their daughter's meds. And by the way, this game on this treadmill, this is straight from the book. Ben tells Sheila the bad news of him not being able to get his job back, and Sheila says that he's just being punished for being a good man and that they're in this together. Sheila notices a sock that's missing. Oh boy, this sock. As Ben sees Sheila going back to work to make more money for their daughter's meds, she says that she doesn't have a choice, and Ben says yes, they do, as he looks at other shows to try out for that's not The Running Man. Ben makes a promise that he's going to get Sheila and their daughter out of there. And she ends this by saying they need him and begs him not to hurt himself. This is right when the opening credits start. It's right after this. So we have quite the setup here. Matt, what do you feel about the setup?
I think it's simplistic to a fault. And if you're gonna make me sit here for, you know, 2 hours plus, I kind of want to get to know these characters a little bit more, or at least explain how we got to this point where society is basically 2026, but where corporations rule everything and the network, I mean, it's literally just called The Network, which I think is also very lazy, which by the way, I must say, this movie has a lot of shorthand screenwriting that I think is a problem, where I think it takes a lot of shortcuts and leaves things underdeveloped. And to me, the whole point of doing this, I think, would be to explain more. Because the original, it explains everything in a friggin' wall of text, mm-hmm. which I always bitch about. So there's no crawl here, but I think a lot of this feels unremarkable, and you could pick it out of a lineup of like 10 other futuristic movies. Like it doesn't feel enough like its own thing, and that's disappointing because I think Edgar Wright always has a very clear strength of setting up a world, especially with characters, and I don't think that's here.
I'm going to say something right now, Matt, and as you know, two people who have followed Edgar Wright's career, he was out in the press when this movie was coming out saying this was a huge passion project for him. He said, in 2017, he was like, I had a vision for this. I know I really want to do it. With the exception of one scene, which is given away in the trailer, I don't find any of Edgar Wright's signature here. Yeah, there's a rhythmic notion to it. There's a feeling that, you know, like Baby Driver had, where everything is to a beat. But other than that, Matt, do you feel any of Edgar Wright's signature here?
Outside of the editing, I don't. I think that's a calling card of his, but I don't feel a lot of his particular style. There's only one part where I feel like his sense of humor comes through, but that character and that whole part feels very brief and abbreviated, which is surprising given how fucking long this movie is. Yeah. And like, we're going to review a 3+ hour movie very soon that I saw in a theater, so I shouldn't be complaining too much, but I just feel like for the amount of real estate they had and a director who's very unique, this feels very, ironically, very corporatized. I don't want to say he sold out, but this feels like he took it for the paycheck. I don't feel a whole lot of inspiration, especially since, to your point, he's being very faithful to the book. I wanted this to be more like the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, where, yeah, he got hired to bring that to the big screen. But those movies are clearly Sam Raimi productions. Mm-hmm.
To Matt's point, to your point, I see with the editing, I see some attempts at it. I feel like this is, he got partway through this and went, if I quit another one, this is going to be like Ant-Man all over again, and I will never make anything other than my own small budget movies. I feel like he got so far into this that he couldn't quit at a certain point. I see the flourishes there, but they're far and few between, and I do think when they're there, they shine, but then it's problematic because it contradicts and runs contrary to the way the film moves, and that's just hurtful. I think he could have made this like as an episode of The Running Man, and you would have had something kind of fucking cool and different and innovative. And I think Edgar Wright has, or you know what? Edgar Wright had innovation about him. I think he needs to bring it back. I don't see anything here that couldn't have been done by Johnny Off the Shelf filmmaker.
By Simon Kinberg.
By Simon Kinberg. By anybody that Simon Kinberg hires for any of his projects.
We're also in an era where I smell some Kingism, in the sense that, you know, those early adaptations we've talked about, you really had directors making them their own. And I feel like there's a turning point in King's career where they kind of lose that directorial stamp because they're trying to adhere more to his vision. I wonder if that's the case here.
I am not enjoying what I'm watching. Like, I'm into this. But at the same time, I know what Wright's capable of, and I miss it.
Well, Wright, in all his interviews leading up to this, did say that King, after the development of it, where he had approval of the script and everything else, he pretty much stayed out of it. Like, he didn't make any directorial choices or anything, if that's what you're asking. But I do think he is feeling pressure to adhere to it because his name is on as a producer. So, I don't know. It is a tightrope that he does try to walk, but I don't envision Edgar Wright as walking a tightrope. I envision Edgar Wright doing his movie, or as Adam mentioned, leaving a production like Ant-Man because he can't do his own vision.
Well, that also happened with The Adventures of Tintin.
Yep.
If you remember, look, he was never talked about directing that movie, but Spielberg called him to write the script, and Wright gave some notes, but he basically passed it off to Steve Moffat. So Wright, I think, has always had a certain reluctance with doing, you know, big properties, or, you know, certainly with Tintin, he would have been working very closely with Spielberg, but it would have been Spielberg kind of holding his hand. And Scott Pilgrim, the writer of the comic, he was heavily involved in the production of that movie. So I wonder if the whole thing of like, oh, I'm 100% on my own, like I don't have anyone to answer to, but I also don't have the leeway to 100% make this my own thing because I also have to, you know, stay out of the shadow of Schwarzenegger, which is not really here outside of one very distinctive hallmark.
Yes.
which we'll talk about later. But one compliment to this, I was not thinking of the Schwarzenegger movie routinely while watching this.
No.
Which I think is a good sign of a remake.
Yep. Agreed.
So we see Ben make his way to the Running Man in a hoodie. He then goes through the door after stating his destination, and he gets in line. One guy behind him throws up and falls, and as Ben bends down to help him, he gets in a fight with a guard. He then gets to the front of the line, and he sees a red triangle by his name, and when he asks why it's there, the guy behind the desk just keeps mentioning his daughter. This causes Ben to punch the glass, because again, we have to see this guy's temper. He then meets number 29, a.k.a. Laughlin, a.k.a. Katie O'Brien, a chick who just seems to be in every new release we're doing, guys. Can't get away from this guy.
Laughlin, he's a fan of our show, that's why.
She's in everything other than she should have been, which is The Last of Us Part 2.
Well, don't. Now, if you guys remember, Laughlin was the name of Yaphet Kotto's character in the first Running Man, so a little tribute to that.
Mm-hmm.
We get very little of her. We see her die later on at a rave type thing, but in the Schwarzenegger production, you know, Maria Conchita Alonso's kind of helping Ben along the way. Here, they're off doing their own thing. Matt, did you like the fact that everybody's kind of doing their own thing in this?
I mean, it makes it different, which I think is always the path you should take. But I think it's also hurt by the fact that this movie's trying to do a lot of different things, you know, because there's the... They kept the sort of the revolution angle with one particular character that we're going to meet soon. There's obviously the politic, the message in this movie, which is about as subtle as getting slapped in the face by, you know, a sledgehammer. But I don't think it works all that well, because for a TV show that everybody watches, and clearly they have no problem getting contestants because the show's been on for God knows how long, all the other contestants feel really disposable, and they might as well be wearing red shirts.
Yeah.
Like seeing Katie O'Brien, I think she's always a fun presence. Nobody ever used her enough. And I think whatever they planned, there's a different version or three different versions of this movie that got to be floating out there. Because she's here, she's then something else, and then she's utilized later on only to set up the way that these characters' ends happen. And I just feel like there was more that was done, that was originally filmed, written, and done. But I like when I see her here. I wasn't expecting it.
Ben goes to elevator 6, and he meets the other contestant here, Tim, which is short for Timothy. Ben gets dressed, and the tryouts begin. People fall off treadmills as they go through an obstacle course, and this is all American Gladiators type shit, right?
This is freaking Squid Game the game. Like, this is the new version of it, where they're doing a reality show version of Squid Game. That's what this is. And yes, American Gladiators. How do you not bring that back?
Yeah.
The Rock messed up by bringing up Titan Games. God damn it. You know where this is going. Just get there. This movie's a little too long. Just run to where you got to go.
Yeah, that's been Matt's point already in this movie, and we're not 30 minutes in. Ben helps someone out and then gets into a word association, which is probably my favorite part of this of this setup here, is this whole word association. He associates family with everything. And then he gets called the angriest man to ever try out for the show, and Ben responds that really pisses him off. They get into designated jumpsuits, and did you guys see any of the Stephen King Easter eggs here? I saw one of the jumpsuits. The name on it was Danny Torrance.
Well, I did catch that. Yeah,
a nice little touch there by Edgar Wright. As Laughlin and Richards meet Jansky. Jansky says it's feeling pretty real right now, and then he calls Ben the man before him and Laughlin leave, and Laughlin promises to keep it down. We then go into Dan Killian's office, as he says that the critics say The Running Man is a return to barbarism. And Ben says that he'll do any other show that isn't The Running Man. Killian tries convincing him, and Ben says that he's not going to get himself killed, but Killian says he's got what it takes to make it. Killian then says that he's gone through Ben's employment history, and then says that Ben can win this game because he's a fighter.
Okay, I also understand this is, to my knowledge, part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I think he gets convinced way too easily. And I also don't like... This movie's not subtle at all. Could we have renamed him from something other than Kill Eaton? Like, it works in the original movie because that thing is so heightened. It's, you know, 80s rock and wrestling. But in this, where everything is very in your face to the point where instead of the weakness like Survivor, this should have been like that show where you just... Instead of arm wrestling, you slap each other until you quit. That's basically what this felt like. I'm being browbeaten with a message that I agree with, but I don't feel like this movie knows how to balance the preaching with being an entertaining action movie.
Yeah, I think by trying to tread both, it does both fine. It just doesn't elevate. I do think I get some menace out of Brolin in this scene, which I enjoy. But this scene feels like it's aftershot. It feels like it's, you know, hey, we got him. This feels like one of those, put him in a soundstage somewhere and do some reshoots because Brolin's going to stick around for a little bit.
So we just Skype screen and then edited like a background.
Yeah. Killian says that if Ben signs the agreement, he can change his family's life forever. Ben signs, and Killian smiles and says, welcome to the Running Man. We see more flashes of Ben's anger, and this is stuff I don't think Powell can play very well. Ben's told that he won't have to worry about his family, as they will be under an assumed name, and Ben gives the guard a missing sock and asks the guard to give that to him. He then calls Sheila and tells her that he's on the Running Man. He tells her that he loves her and hangs up. He then turns on the Americanos, a.k.a. the Kardashians. Why, Edgar, why? What is this bullshit?
See, this is really weird because usually Edgar Wright is very clever.
Yes.
With his sense of humor, like the whole part of what makes Hot Fuzz so funny is that the whole plot is basically making fun of all those, you know, those movies where the cops are either superheroes or the plot is way too convenient and no one's willing to call it out. And he's very good with subversion. This is so blatantly in your face. And it's a joke that's 10 years outdated.
That was my point.
The Kardashians have not been outside of appearances on other things. Like, they're not the queens or goblins of reality TV that they were 10 years ago.
Yeah, that was going to be my point, is that this is a joke 10 years too late, and I don't think of Edgar Wright as doing that.
Yeah, I agree. This is one where, I don't know, this feels like MGM is just like, you got to include it. Yeah, I mean, look, maybe this is what he's doing if it's not for himself. You know, homeboy's still got to get paid, but do something better.
The only thing I kind of liked about this is it was fun seeing Debbie Mazar in this. Like, I haven't seen that broad in years. So seeing her here kind of made me laugh. And I thought maybe they were going to play a bigger part of this. Like, later on, we're going to see a character where I thought maybe, like, since she's watching this show, I thought maybe she's going to be a part of it. But no, it's just there as background.
Yeah, I thought one of the contestants on the Running Man was going to be Madonna. And yeah, she was competing for her freedom.
Ben gets sent a picture of his wife and son as Coleman Domingo shows up on the TV. And then Ben gets handed a bracelet called the Running Brand, which is used for timers, reminders, and rewards. All right, I do really enjoy Coleman Domingo in this. I think he's really fun as this host.
Steals the show.
Yeah.
I mean, to decide that you're going to have to outdo what was done in the first one, because if you're going to have your game show host, it's a little different than you get with Josh Brolin. You know, at least he gets to be like, he doesn't really have a direct comparison, kind of, but to take on this role, how do you outdo, you know, one of the classic game show hosts of all time? Man, he is fun. He brings it. I love seeing the dancers. I mean, it's quick. You don't get him nearly as much as you did in that first movie, but it just feels like that slight homage. But fuck, he's fun. You know, and then later on that he actually has some interplay with Brolin and stuff and who he is, like, it, I could have done more of this.
Yeah, he's definitely the highlight of the movie. He reminds me a lot of Stanley Tucci from the Hunger Games, and I don't say that in a bad way, but it's clear they kind of took inspiration from that, and you have the leniency to do that as well by splitting off these two, making them two distinctive characters. But I think he's the type of energy this movie desperately needs, and I wish the rest of the movie was as heightened as his performances. Because I think it would have made this feel more both futuristic and more just overall fun.
But as much as I like Domingo here, why isn't this Steve Harvey?
This is Steve Harvey.
Right, I mean, he's got the mustache.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe it was too expensive, but I don't know. I just thought
that's the thing. Like, so many like game show hosts nowadays don't have any personality.
Yeah,
they're just there to read cue cards. Or
Steve Harvey doesn't let you talk to him when he's not on the stage, so I don't think he's doing a movie.
That's true.
Oh yeah, I guess Family Feud hosts, you have to be the biggest asshole in the world to
win. Yeah, apparently.
Get a gig on that show, unless you're Louis Anderson, who's like the one nice guy.
I know. I gotta say, Garrett, you brought up this device that they attach to him for the rewards and the countdown and all that. People are looking for these guys, for these people. So let's put a giant orange Pit Boy on your arm. This thing I could see from the space station, man.
Yeah, this feels like you're putting them at a tremendous disadvantage. I thought the whole point of this was going to be that it's like fixed in the same way that the original was, because there was that whole like other group that Killian had murdered to kind of cheat the system. Because this is such like an obvious, you know, might as well be a literal red flag that you just plant in the back of their sweatshirt.
No, that's his hoodie, which is literally his red flag.
Which I also had a problem with. I'm like, you had those really distinctive like jumpsuits in the original, and the costume design in here is
pretty
uninspired. And that's one thing I've also liked about Wright's movies, like Last Night in Soho. The production design and the costuming in that movie is outstanding. Baby Driver, he does a lot of fun stuff with the outfits that people are wearing and the way the headphones are incorporated. Here, there's not a whole lot of those flourishes.
Ben is led to the stage by Killian, who tells him to shake his dick at the crowd to show off his machismo.
As I'd have a nickel for every time my boss told me.
I'd have 8 nickels.
Domingo's Bobby T calls that a bad note. We then see the intro, which calls America the best country in the fucking universe. I do like this intro video, which tells the crowd to record, report, and reward. And then, Adam, as you mentioned, we get a nice tribute to the Schwarzenegger movie with these dancers on the stage. And Bobby T,
you know what?
Gets introduced.
When we got earlier with the money is Arnold Bunny. Like, yes. Arnold is the president on the money, which I thought was perfect. But this right here, this show intro, this should have been the opening to the movie. Failure. This is how you start the movie, was with this, and then you cut to Ben and go through his stuff. So I like this. This is the energy that should have kicked it all off.
Yeah, there was a world where you could have done this with, like, flashbacks. You start with a movie called The Running Man with him being chased. And knowing Wright, I could have seen like a smash cut freeze frame. He's like, you're probably wondering how I got here.
Going back to the money, though, I think that's one of the best integrated cameos I've seen. Perfect tribute, I thought, to Schwarzenegger. Especially since Schwarzenegger, you know, wanted to be president. He was governor of California for a bit.
Feels like that longtime joke of adjusting the Constitution so Arnold could be president.
So funny.
He was my governor.
He was. Killian tells Ben to embrace his anger, which is his superpower. Ben's booed off the stage as Bobby says that he bit the hand that feeds him because that's what dogs do. He then calls Ben's wife Sheila a night witch, and we even see their daughter Kathy here. Bobby asks Ben if he has any famous last words, and Ben says, fuck you, Killian. Killian advises Ben to lay low and that every goon he kills is an extra $10,000. Ben responds that he's going to fuck Killian up. We're then seeing the rules displayed on the screen, and okay, here we go, Matt. I have the perfect way to keep this thing under 2 hours. Why is this fucking competition 30 days? Way too long. Like, why can't you just make this a week? It elongates all this, and I know he's trying to be faithful, but goddamn, you got to narrow this down.
Well, it also runs the problem of you're stacking the deck so heavily against the contestants that it's remarkable that there have been any winners. So you're kind of having to hedge your bet as an audience member and be like, okay, there's clearly going to be some kind of like rig or resource that he's going to be able to use as leverage because it's so, and they haven't even thought about the hunter momentarily. They changed that, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I thought the 30-day thing, I mean, that's Survivor. It's usually 39 days. But to your point, yeah, if you want to cut down some of this runtime, that's the easiest way to do it.
It's not a problem for me at the beginning. It's a big problem for me as we get towards the middle of this and I start feeling time jumps that make no sense whatsoever that I don't understand.
We then meet the hunters, which may be amongst anybody, as they say. He then says the three out as the crowd chants, let them run. How about these tubes that send them down? Another nice little tribute to that first film. Ben goes to a table and sees some gear. He walks outside and here we go, boys. The game is on. He gets in a cab and Matt, is it just me? Or speaking of Total Recall, is this a Johnny cab from Total Recall?
That was it basically is.
Yeah, so weird.
There's a lot of Philip K. Dick influences in this because the whole like everyone's out to get you and you're always being watched. That reminds me of the Adjustment Bureau.
Oh, yeah.
Everything's sort of like predetermined. But yeah, I found a lot of like Dick influences in this.
Definitely. The driver asks for a pick and says that he's a nice guy and Ben better be nice to anyone he meets. Ben then gets out as the driver calls him dead meat. He moves through these deserted streets and then goes to William H. Macy. What are you doing here, sir?
What's with his career lately where he just randomly shows up in these big movies? And the question's always, why are you here?
I know. He was such a respected actor. He just had a really long-running show, too. Why is he just showing up in these random cameos?
Like, is he trying to pay so his wife can get out of prison? Like,
I don't know.
I have an answer, and I would recommend everybody go listen to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum, because he's on The Guest about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, was he?
Oh, yes, he was. It's a fascinating interview. You would both love it.
Molly says he doesn't do guns and then gets mad at Ben for how much danger he put him in by coming down while he's on the Running Man. And Molly even takes his picture for a new ID. He advises Ben to disappear in the crowd as Ben tells him he had to do it. This is a character straight from the book. I mean, again, they're being loyal here. How do we feel about this scene with William H. Macy, Matt, as small as it is?
Again, why wasn't this like Nick Frost? Even right down to the casting doesn't feel like he had much input on this. The point of getting a director like him is you want to see his, feel his input. And, you know, plenty of other directors. I mean, John Carpenter did it. Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi, they might as well be joined at the hip. Scorsese's done it. Spielberg's done it. Like, I'm totally okay with directors, especially for a part as minuscule as this.
Yeah. So Molly responds that actually he didn't have to be here because he was going to bring him onto his team anyway. Adam, this feels a little convenient, doesn't it?
It feels dropped in. Like, I don't understand how we're suddenly here. Like, this dude's prepped for it, but we don't get the relationship. I don't know. I don't understand how they're connected, and we're not really given a reason. It's just, here we go. Mm-hmm. It's so choppy. And this isn't the worst one.
No.
But you know what? If you want to have someone to drop it, if you're going to have somebody make masks and disguises, have full-blown fun and have Simon Pegg. Mm-hmm. Because after Mission Impossible, I would have fallen out of my seat just in joy with that being the way to go.
Yeah.
That would have been actually pretty funny. But also, I feel like they're getting their wires crossed because this is like the whole like Total Recall thing with the 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yep.
Molly sends Ben off by saying, "See you on the big screen." Ben goes to an automated teller for a ticket, and she bids Mr. Springer safe travels. We see him on the train as his bracelet says that the hunt is on, and the kid points out that Ben's mustache is coming off as Ben heads to the hotel. Matt, this goes to your point that these disguises suck, right?
Yeah, and it makes it all the more ridiculous because we find out how, like, deepfake is incorporated into the game and society in general, which feels like a stark contrast because why would you bother with physical disguises in the first place? Which, for the record, the deepfake is only here for, well, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
They make this joke in Hitman with his disguises and falling off? I can't believe you literally did the same thing.
This place to Glenn Powell's strengths is this is what he did in Hitman is to do the disguises. So I see why Edgar Wright did this. So Ben then heads to the hotel and he starts coughing and bids the teller a good night as he goes to his room and puts a do not disturb sign on the door. And guys, I'm going to say, you know, I've said a few bad things about the opening, but I was actually kind of going with the opening of this film. I was kind of going with the film up to this point. This, though, is when those films kind of takes a downturn for me. I was happy seeing the intro to the games, and I was happy seeing Ben go through the trials, but all this stuff with him in these rooms and looking out the window, all this shit, it's kind of monotonous to me, and I kind of fall out of favor with the film at this point.
You know, for a movie called The Running Man, I'm almost like pacing in my seat and in my brain internally. I'm waiting for the shock and the, like, a cow prod for this movie to inject some life into me.
I'm looking at my note that's right here as you get to it, and it says, "I am over these dreams and flashbacks already. Just keep it moving forward." And that's my problem. Like, I don't need the dreams. I don't need them. Just keep the propulsion moving. It's The Running Man. Run.
Yeah.
Edgar, run.
Right. Ben's once again watching the Americanos as a bitch shows up at his window, and we see that Macy is in a bad way, being taken nose first into a table, and he yells his name, John Springer. We see the hunters track Ben down. They head to the hotel. We see him on the bed, put a gun to his head, and pull the trigger. But guys, this is just a dream. And Adam, this goes to your point. Enough of these dreams. Enough of this flashes. Just keep going, right?
It doesn't serve a purpose.
No. We do see Tim get offed. He's the first one to go, with Bobby T saying, "One down, two to go." I was sad to see the nerd go so quick. But
I feel like with 30 days, you could have had, I don't know, maybe 10 people. So that you could have had some innovative kills to make the hunters seem, I don't know, a little more formidable and just have some fodder out there.
Well, I feel like they did that to avoid the Hunger Games comparison because that has so many contestants. And the whole point would be like, okay, if you have that many, why aren't they allowed to hurt each other?
Ben then leaves the hotel. He goes and tries to buy a jacket off a guy's back as a kid runs by him. And I love this misspelled broken sign as an English major. This made me laugh. Ben then makes one of his tapes and has him check in. Now, this was weird. Edgar, if you're going to update this, why do you have this mailbox thing of him having to drop these in the fucking mailbox? Like, you send it digitally. Like, this is just, you're just trying to create more danger with this? Is that all he's doing?
Well, again, I just feel like the odds are so heavily against the contestants that it makes you wonder, how is the show still on the air?
Mm-hmm.
If it's rigged to this degree. Because, like, the original, one of the things that helped with the quote-unquote realism as far as, like, not feeling too edged is that you're dropped off in like a quarantine zone. So it's not like you have dozens of people going after you. It's only the hunters. But here, I feel like between the hunter and the rest of the populace being against you, which that part I actually like, where you're having to work around a society that is all about selling people out for a quick buck. But outside of that, I feel like it's too much superfluous fluff in a lot of this, to be honest.
I never thought I would say that in an Edgar Wright film. It breaks my heart, because say what you will about Last Night in Soho, I at least felt him trying to do something different and innovative in that. I don't feel that here. So Ben says that he's a grown-ass man playing hide and seek for money. He says that he's going to lay low and advises the crowd not to burn out. I do like Ben standing in this room and projecting the conversation the guys on the ground are having. I always like this kind of stuff. They used to do this on Angel a lot, where, like, Spike.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, Spike would be up watching Angel talk to somebody and say what he thought Angel was saying. Like, this is the kind of stuff I kind of like. Matt, was that oh my God because you didn't like this?
No, oh my God because you're right.
Yeah.
I do like that part of it, and I think that's where his charm does come through, and I think it's here in moments. Is the way to him having to videotape himself and send it in, hey, I think we've all learned physical media still matters, everybody. So keep it going.
Maybe that is Edgar Wright's jab at that. I didn't think about that.
It very well could be.
So Ben takes a shower and puts on this towel as he grabs his key. He sees that he's being watched as guys start heading up to his room. He sneaks up the stairs and yells that he saw Ben Richards head downstairs.
Just one. I want just one movie where I don't have to see Glenn Powell's ass. It's in the contract, like Sydney Sweeney's tits. I mean, just come on.
Yeah, but this is for...
Except this one, I don't get tired of seeing.
I was going to say, this is here for Matt's good graces. We didn't see Ben hang off a building and going through a window. We hear Bobby say that the hunters have found their man and all actions have consequences. The hunters are outside the door as Ben loads up and gets dressed and then heads out as he's being shot at.
So I don't like how the hunters are just generics. 90% of them are just generic soldiers.
They all have masks. I'm with you. I guess this is your way to distinguish it from 1987 because all of them were so cartoonish. But,
yeah, but they might as well have freaking ice on their heads. Wow. And then the one main hunter we meet later on might as well have a Cobra logo on his back.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wait till we get there.
These guys are stormtroopers, and they shoot like stormtroopers.
Yes, they do.
Which, it took me all of about 10 seconds to go, man, they are really bad shots. Why can't they? Oh. Like, they make it so obvious that I know exactly what the play is right here with this scene. But some of this is fun. Some of this is exactly the kinetic Edgar Wright action that I've been looking for, but then it stops and it turns into rote. Anybody could have directed this action, even just in this one scene.
Yeah.
It's really strange that way.
So yeah, that's
the other thing, like another thing that Edgar Wright does with a lot of his movies, and I feel like he didn't do this because James Gunn has kind of used this for the last like decade plus. He scores a lot of his action scenes to music.
Yeah.
You have the whole Don't Stop Me Now scene in Shaun of the Dead. I feel like he didn't do that here, like I said, because Gunn has done it so much recently. But it also makes this feel just like generic action, which was one of my biggest disappointments with the movie, is that the action, it doesn't suck, but it's so uninspired and workmanlike.
Well, you know what? You may have hit one of the things, Matt, that I never thought of it till right now. Edgar Wright's movies always have music that kind of propel right along. This doesn't.
It does, but it's very subtle. It's in the chants and in the way he shoots those scenes.
But I mean, I'm talking needle drops.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Because Edgar Wright's movies as a whole, you always have some of those needle drops. And I get this is dystopian. It's a different time. But I do, and I didn't think of it till just now, I am missing that.
So Ben hangs off the Y and heads into another room, and the chase is back on. He yells to stop being filmed as McCabe proclaims that Ben's going down. Ben yells that he has a grenade, and it gets kicked right back to him. And this is the scene that I was talking about earlier, where this felt very Edgar Wright. I like this a lot. But this was in a trailer that I saw at least 15 times leading up to this fucking movie. And if you blow this scene, why bother fucking releasing the goddamn movie? Okay, nobody else felt bad that they got spoiled by this scene, huh? Well, I did.
No, well, I felt bad because I thought this, if this wasn't in the trailer, I would have actually laughed at it.
Yeah. Because as it's coming, I know what happens. I know the end. And I know it's going to end with him, like, coming up out of the water, flipping off the camera. Like, I've seen this scene, as you said, 15 times.
Ben then lays his eyes on some nudie magazines as he once again gets shot at. He makes his way further down as fire follows him, and the entire building blows up.
So I thought the magazines, that was a reference to, like, pornography being outlawed in the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. He emerges from the rat-infested sewers, Indiana Jones style, as he looks at his camera and says that he's still here, shit-eaters. Ben then grabs a kid who promises that he didn't report him and then says that his brother is going to save his ass. We see a dead goon bonus appear on the screen as we see that we're now on day 5. The kid returns with his brother, and Ben gives them some meds to give to their sister. He says that he runs faster every day, and we cut to him eating at their place. Ben says that he doesn't get why they're not turning him in, and he's told that he can get taken to Boston if he wants. And Ben says that he's just trying to take care of his family. He gets told to hide out as an escape route is set up, and we're seeing the Apostle TV show, which I'm guessing is a conspiracy-type YouTube show.
Yeah, it's basically Charlie Kirk.
Yeah, this YouTuber hood.
So this is the problem with trying to do television satire in a modern updated movie, because Fox News has ruined the ability to do this with any semblance of sincerity. Like, this is one of the things that killed the RoboCop remake, was the Sam Jackson character, which is basically less cartoonish than, you know, the O'Reilly Factor. Here it's that same similar effect where this is so, like, low-key compared to the real life thing that it doesn't work as satire.
Boy, I'm gonna have a lot to say about the Apostle when we get to the end. We're seeing all the different...
I wanted to throw a Hail Mary to rewrite this movie at the end.
I thought I was gonna get another text from you when I came out of this, given the conversation we had last year. We're seeing all the different types of quote-unquote dudes the Running Man hires for ratings, and Ben's called the final dude. Ben makes his new video as he says that the network is giving their kids cancer and covering it up. Ben is then shown on TV as a sort of monster, and like the previous film, he's being portrayed as somebody who he isn't, as his video is being manipulated. But somebody touched on this earlier, I gotta say it again, this deepfake stuff, this was hit on in 1987 with the Jesse Ventura character. It feels so old hat at this point.
Exactly, and it felt futuristic there. Here, it feels like 5 years ago. So it's just, you got to find a way to make this something that we would be scared of in just a little bit. Maybe an automatic AI that's doing that. Well, fuck no. I've had enough AI Mission Impossible. Thank you. but something to make this, because we're not futuristic. This movie's no longer futuristic. It's 2021. And I think that may be its biggest foible.
Yeah, I mean, it's a step behind in the way that Hollywood took forever to start using, like, smartphones.
This causes Ben to get kicked out of where he is because the mom sees this and is like, yeah, you're not staying in our house, as we're seeing a car ride in a trunk from Ben's point of view.
I didn't like that.
You like that, huh? He's getting knocked around a bit as the chase is on, and then the trunk gets flung open, and this is the first bit of propulsion I felt since this film's opening minutes, boys. I do like this chase a lot. Matt, you're saying that this isn't the type of action you expect?
No, I wanted something a little bit more kinetic, a little bit more inventive. And I don't feel like that's here. And look, you have no excuse, because that's the biggest problem with the original, is the action.
I want more of it. I get occasional flashes of Edgar Wright action, and then I feel like Brett Ratner's fucking is ghost directing some of this.
Oh my God, why'd you have to bring that name up?
I know, bad name, but I feel like X-Men 3 type of action.
I even like the spray-painted wipe that Edgar Wright does here. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah, that's another thing also, like, he's very good about, and this is going to sound weird coming from me, the way he uses color. All of his Cornetto yes. movies have a very yes. distinctive color and flavor to them, which is perfectly intentional. But there's a lot of, you know, even Baby Driver, the way he uses color in some of those sequences where every character is wearing a different color. Again, this feels so workmanlike that there's no directorial stamp on it.
Big Bro, as he's called, sends Ben on his way, and he even gives him a gun. We see that Little Bro spray painted the wall with Richard's Lives. Ben sends in his new video, and I love this. He's saying that he's eaten his favorite meal, which is defenseless puppies. He blew up a courthouse, and tonight he's going to make love to an illegal immigrant's sheep. This is the kind of stuff I think Glenn Powell's good at, is this stuff.
I'd make a great episode of Black Mirror.
We then see a partying Laughlin send in her video, and we see some prop bets on how long each contestant is going to last, and we even see a dressed as a Reverend Richards saying in an English accent that this Richards guy sounds like quite the character. I didn't like this fucking Reverend stuff.
No, but I could have used almost... Again, it goes back to Hitman. I could have used just this kind of fun. Like, it's not great, but it breaks up some of the other monotony. You know, at least it's changing it. It's, oh my god, it's not as good as something like The Saint, you know, where some of the scenes are horrible, but you're like, okay, but he's having fun.
Yeah, or like, this should have been like Fletch.
Good oh, Lord, yeah, Christ. Yeah, yeah. Just enjoy yourself a little bit. You know, you gotta play that line.
I can't believe you
brought it. Or if you're gonna be like this satirical, this should take place in a world where like blackface is okay. Or do the thing like Bond got killed for, where he pretends to be Chinese. Well, or Japanese, excuse me.
You can't do that now.
No, but like, have fun with that.
We're now on day 10, as we're hearing more of Richard's video saying that he's not here to have fun, he's here to win. Ben's then stopped by somebody who's asking if he's going to hell for using rubbers, which was a funny little aside. A fight then ensues, as again, we have a chase. Ben hops a fence, and then he goes onto a moving train. And now we're on day 13. So, Adam, like you're saying, this is a time jump. Like, what happened in that 3 days?
What happened from 5 to 10? What happened from 10 to 13? Is he still doing video? I can't even recall how. Does he got to do videos every 5 days? Once? I don't know.
It's supposed to be once a day.
Is it once a day?
Yeah.
Okay. Look, if you're going to do this, change it. Say you got to get from this city to this city. At least we know the path he's going. I don't know where he's going. I don't know what city he's in other than the occasional little drop. I don't know why he's going from a city to a farmland to suddenly showing up at somebody's door. Like, I just jumped fucking 30 minutes in this movie and something got cut out.
It's so weird in a movie that is over 2 hours where we're complaining about the fact that they didn't explain things. It's all about narrowing it down, right? Matt, it's about narrowing a script down so that it actually flows a little bit better, right?
Oh, this thing is... I think the script is largely pretty bad, especially from the dialogue. Like, I don't laugh at any of the jokes or the exchanges. I wonder if the real running man was Edgar Wright and he left the camera running and someone else directed this movie.
He ran away with his check that he got paid for this.
I want to have a few chuckles a little later with a character we meet here in a little bit, but I'm mostly with you, though, in a movie that is directed by Edgar Wright. Again, I just don't feel like it's an Edgar Wright film. Ben says if he dies, he's going to die for his wife and kid, the only two things he believes in, and everybody else can go fuck off. We didn't see that Laughlin was chased through a casino. She hops into a Barbie car and takes off, but she fizzles on the Nevada road and is then set afire. So now there's only one.
This is going to sound... I don't know. I don't want to come across sounding Cro-Magnon or misogynistic, but you have this massive hedonistic party in Vegas with drugs and women and cussing and violence, and everybody is completely covered up. It literally took me out of a scene that, I mean, this is like a PG-13 spice movie. Like, you have no problem with every other level of violence and cussing and everything else, but when you have this debauchery and sex going on, everybody is covered. It was enough that I'm like, that doesn't make any sense, that it took me out, that you don't have a single titty shot or dick shot in all of that going on.
Yeah, it's the double standard, but you had Glenn Powell's bare ass.
Yeah.
Which is far less common in movies nowadays than it used to be.
Like, that would have been the way, even just panning through that casino. To not do it seems, I don't know, it just felt non-authentic.
We then see Ben enter the home of Scott Pilgrim himself, Michael Cera. This was a surprise and a pleasant one. I like Cera in this film, even if I didn't like his facial hair. I like, and again, character straight from the book. Now, there is no hot dog cart in that book. That's all made up for this film, but I like Michael Cera in this.
He's the only thing that really feels like a right characterization and performance, to the point where, we talked about this earlier, I kind of wish he was the star. I want to see that alternate version. Because I think that would have been a fun, like, you know, Wright's always good about, you know, traversals and subversion. Michael Cera is the furthest thing from an action star. It would have been fun to see. And I think you could have had satire of that, where the Killian's losing his mind that this, like, stick buffoon is outsmarting him. You know, because that's the whole, like, because Killian is also supposed to be very Trumpish. And this character brings the political revolution angle, which was from the original movie. But did they have him for, like, a day and that was it?
That's why this way, doesn't it? So quick.
Why did we show up to this house suddenly?
Because they had, like, to go to Derry, Maine.
Yep.
I mean, where is this? Derry. Why is this? Is it? Okay.
Yeah, then you missed the sign that said "Welcome to Derry" because Pennywise was taking care of that on HBO.
Literally, I blinked and I missed it because I was like, "Why do we show up randomly at this person's house?"
No, because Bradley sends him there.
Then that's on me because I missed it. All right. And then I feel better about it.
And in this book written in 1972, that was in it, was Derry.
Oh, Derry.
Ben's taken into Elton's place, and Elton says that Ben needs to go underground ASAP. We then hear Ben ask, what is up with the hot dog cart? So we hear that backstory. And this is all before... This was so weird. This is all before Elton takes a sip of a Monster Energy drink. What's up with the fucking product placement in this goddamn movie? It's trying to be so anti-corporate, but Matt, to your point, yeah, we're anti-corporate, but we're going to get paid by all this product that we're placing in this movie, but don't do that.
It's also a weird one because Monster is not the brand that people think it is anymore, because the energy drink market has become, much like network television, incredibly overly saturated. So what are you trying to, like, might as well be Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
Because this was like, it was a joke for, like, video gamers.
But do this in a way like Demolition Man did. Really revel in it.
Yeah.
You're a TV show. Find a way just that the product placement, you could have just gone, I don't know, Demolition Man. Like, it's the best way I could think of it.
Yeah, there literally should have been in a dystopian future where the network rules everything. Why is there not, like, a billboard, like in the original, every 5 seconds, or the show, like, commercials in between? Domingo should be wearing logos on his jacket like a NASCAR racer.
I like these symbols, even these flyers with Ben's face on them. I think this is kind of fun that Elton makes up. Elton says that
apparently in the future, though, we live in a society that still uses paper.
Yeah.
Where everything's digital. Like, this makes no sense.
None. Elton says that this country is getting ready to blow, and Ben's the initiator. Elton says that one can only hope that the goons catch up to him. Ben sends in his new video with Ben giving some rules to his daughter. He's then recognized by Elton's mom, who's set to turn Ben in, but it's Elton who ends up doing it. So here we go again, guys. The goons show up and the shooting begins as we're seeing Ben maneuver through this bugged house. And Elton makes his bacon extra crispy, as he says. I thought this was pretty fun.
Well, I like that this is like the Home Alone house where everything's booby-trapped. And...
awesome. Yeah.
But, again, Edgar Wright, this should have been Macaulay Culkin. That would have been hysterical.
I like this. This is fun. It comes, you know, two-thirds of the way in, three-quarters of the way through. But I'm having fun here. And I think Wright is having fun here. I think this is what he wanted to do. Even the stuff that is eye-rolling throwbacks to the original movie is fun and has its place. But this, the action is not as good, but it's the action I want. It's an Edgar Wright scene.
I rewatched this week because, you know, this movie came out 3 months ago. But as I'm watching it, the most I laughed in this rewatch was Ben asking why they're going upstairs just so they can slide down a pole. I don't know why I laughed so hard at that, but it broke me.
But some of the funniest, like the grenade scene earlier, some of the funniest parts in this were trailerized way too much.
They then head down into more underground caves, and here's Lee Pace to stop them. A fight breaks out as Elton slices McCone's heel, Gage Creed style. Adam, you'll get that reference here pretty soon.
I get it. I get it. I've watched horror compilations.
Ben talks to Killian, who says that the audience lives for these happy accidents. He tells Ben to off one of his guys because it'll make good TV. as Ben shoots down the drone. They then get in a car, and we have a car chase on our hands. We see more of an arsenal in this car as Elton gives some instructions. He then once again calls Richards the initiator as he's shot dead. So, bye, Michael Cera. Nice seeing you while you were here. McCone says that it's the end of Richards' run, as Ben says that he is the initiator as he drives full speed towards McCone and jumps out. This was a little over the top. I don't know. This was really bizarre. Again, another scene from the trailer, though, right, Adam?
Some of it, I pick a lane. Go campy, go insightful, yeah. Or at least a consistent direction that you can occasionally go overboard with. It's jarring.
I like the how it's this little, like, freaking buggy that made me laugh.
Yeah. Ben then goes through a map as Bobby gives more commentary that this is America and they're not going to put up with more bullshit. Money's falling all around Bobby as he proclaims America to hunt Ben down. We see Ben go to a dreamlike house and kiss Sheila and his daughter. And, of course, we see that it looks very dreamlike because it is a dream. Probably Adam's favorite part. Ben sends another message to Killian, who says that this game isn't about him winning or losing. It's about his ratings. And then Ben says that he's done playing defense and he will see his family again. He proclaims the rule book thrown out and that he's set to give America a show. We have more Americanos bullshit as we finally meet Amelia Jones' character of Amelia, and Ben has her drive through danger. This kind of came out of nowhere.
Where did this come from? That was my question. Like, I feel like there's pages from this script that are missing. The way they get from plot point to plot point, set piece to set piece, and you have 30 days to explain this, there shouldn't be this many shortcuts.
Again, just given the fact that we've set up the Americanos 3 or 4 times in this fucking movie and she's watching it, I thought maybe she was going to be a part of it. No, she's just watching it. I hate this so much.
Either cut it or change it. You can use this in a way to explain how he's traversing wherever he's going, or cut it and save me 25 minutes, please.
Didn't this chick win an Oscar, or she was nominated for an Oscar for Coda, right?
I don't think she won. I think
she was nominated. Okay. So I get why you cast her, but this is like the final 30 minutes of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Ben says he now knows why you people need self-driving cars, which actually made me laugh. Yeah. And he tells her to keep the car pointed north. Amelia says that she is a member of society and she should be protected from people like him. He says that the show is fake because it makes people like her look like they're better than people like him. Again, more pal monologues that I don't like. Fucking Dolph Lundgren comes to mind when I watch this fucking monologue. It's just so silly. Ben then says that he'll shoot them both dead if she starts crying. They're pulled over again, this time by some rednecks, and he tells her to go as a drone just takes these guys out. He says that she's now on the show, so she has no choice but to help him. Again, this happens just so fast. In a movie that's over 2 hours, you set this up.
No, you had this be like the halfway point of the movie. This is where the movie changes and they're running together towards the end.
Amelia is shown to be a hostage, and Ben tells her, welcome to the Running Man. They're getting cheered as they drive by. Again, more chance. And Ben calls this a circus. As long as the ratings are good, they will keep living. We're hearing Richards Lives chants, Rocky IV style. They are now on his side.
Yeah, he also wins them over way too easily. Like, yeah. The people who are so dead set about the game and selling people out, boy, they sure come to his side pretty quick, especially since he's not political.
Yeah, exactly. They don't set this up at all.
No.
Ben then tells Killian that he's willing to kill everyone there. He says that he has 12 pounds of black Irish. That is from the book, by the way. That is how King described these explosives, which will vaporize everything within a half-mile radius. He says he wants a flying airplane, and if the trucks don't back up, he'll see them in hell. He then tells Amelia that this is your last chance for her to run, and she says that she now has to prove that she's not the bad guy. They let him through, and then Ben lets Amelia know of his plan. The drone follows them, and Lee Pace is on the plane, preventing Ben from boarding. He takes his mask off, and Ben walks right past him.
Boy, talk about last-minute addition. It's like they watched the original and were writing the script for this and said, oh, we forgot to put hunters in this movie, because that's something people remember. Like, there's a lot of components in this that feel like they're checkbox filmmaking, which I thought he was above, to be perfectly honest. And this is one that if you were going to change this much, then why put them in just for the sake of name value when you don't do anything interesting with him?
I'm not a fan of Lee Pace anyway. Like, when I saw that he was cast in this role, I didn't really like that. So it pulled me towards a negative way anyway. But this is the way they use him here, though, I don't like.
I like Lee Pace. I like what is done. I don't like how it's done. Because you got to keep that what happens to the people that have run before. Did they kill him? No, they turn him into a hunter and they cover his face and they do, though, Hunter 6. I keep thinking of Racer X from freaking Speed Racer.
Oh, nice.
I like that idea. I don't like the way that it's conveyed in this movie, though. You have a scene where it goes really dark with the media manipulation with his wife and daughter. And I think that is the dark, just brilliance that this needs. This part could have been part of that, but we don't learn the how and the why. What did he lose that puts him in this role that makes him and Ben the mirror to each other, which is what this should be. This movie's not interested in that, but I like what's there that's not there.
Well, I think the framework is here, but the problem is this is set up like it should be a reveal to the audience. And if so, you should have mentioned, like, what about the previous winners who've gone missing, or what happened to McCone, who was like the most famous? This should be set up like an actual twist or reveal, sort of like what happened with Last Night in Soho. There's two revelations in that about characters. So the fact that it's not here is just, oh, he's an ex-hunter that took the deal. I kind of wanted more if you were going to include this at all.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm about to get extremely angry. Here we go. So we're meeting the plane's crew, and Ben says that if someone sneaks up on him, it'll be a safe ride, and he tells them that his plan is to fly to Canada. Ben and McCone are about
to... You were mad at the inclusion of Canada?
No.
Garrett really hates poutine, folks.
Ben and McCone are about to go at it, and Ariana is playing along, telling Ben to show him the bomb. Ben tells Killian that if the hunters don't do what he tells them, he's going to blow up the jet and everyone on it. Ben calls his bluff and tells Ben that he can give Amelia back her bag now. Killian says that Ben is the power of illusion and offers him a redemption arc of becoming a hunter. By the way, this is all directly from the book. He offers him a deal of becoming the sixth hunter, and this will be revenge for his wife and child. He says that he'd torture his wife and child in front of him, and that not all accidents are happy. Again, this is all straight from the book, and at this point, guys, I'm thinking of my words from last year, where when we reviewed that original film, I mentioned it ends with Ben flying this plane into the network building. I was wondering if they were going to actually do that actual ending of the book. It was creeping into my mind. Little did I know what was to come. And call it a swerve, call it whatever you want. I call it this movie's lack of balls. I fucking hate what they do with the ending here.
I will call it a narrative cheat and a betrayal. This is the equivalent of taking your dog to be spayed and neutered. With the way, I'm shocked they pulled their punches the way they did, and it sours me on the entire movie as a result. For the last 30 minutes of this, to me, is a train wreck I have not seen since I watched, as far as like going off the rails, this becomes like a Shyamalan level of a dumpster fire.
I didn't think I would say it, but I completely agree with you.
I'm not that upset about it because I see them playing, you know, reference to that book, but then I get upset that they don't do it. It's just, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe they're going to do it. I do think you could do it now, and then they don't. And I'm just trying to figure out what's real, what's manipulated, but the movie hasn't been focused enough on that for this to play off. So it just ends up being, they want their cake, they want to eat it too, and in the meantime, they don't get either.
We see Ben go crazy, break up the monitor, and then he tells Amelia to tune in and find out what happens next. He heads to the cockpit, and this is when Bobby reveals that they kept his family safe. He shoots up the cockpit, and we get a fight between Ben and the pilot. The plane is falling as Ben takes out the pilots. Ben then tells Amelia to strap on the parachute as he goes through, making sure that the bathrooms are empty of hunters. And this is when Lee Pace attacks, as Ben sees that he's bleeding from his gut. Again, straight from the book, except in the book, when he's going through all this, King actually describes his entrails falling out as he's walking. It's pretty vile. He says that the truth is that he's doing Ben a favor, and the plane starts falling. McCone says that you can't hide from destiny. The fight is still on during this free fall as Ben kills McCone and says, that's game. He takes Amelia's scarf and tells her that when she pulls the chute, not to look back. She apologizes, saying that she's sorry that they did this to him, and he responds that he did it to himself, and she flies out the window. Bobby says Killian has another message for him. Killian says that he needs to see more, and they advertise Hunter 6. Ben says he already has a family. Bobby asks Ben how it feels to be a hero. Ben says that he's played the hero game before, but this was the only job he could get to save his daughter. He tells the audience to turn it off as they're all being fucked by the network. Killian claps his hands and says that he's the only one who saw the speech. He says they're going to go live in 30, and he better play by the script or he'll play the alternate audio, which they do. Again, more deepfake.
Yeah, and I wish there was more of this throughout. I really do. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad it's here.
Here we go. The plane heads towards the building as a collision alert happens, and we see the plane is blown up from the sky. Or do we? This is when we're given the real story, because here comes the fucking apostle. Some random chick found the black box, and that's how the truth is shown. We see that Ben did survive as we cut to a store and a display of Fun Twinks cereal. Oh my fucking God.
I thought they were better than this, It would be this. Like, I hate conveniences in movies to begin with, but this is like the worst kind of convenience, where now the master plan gets revealed and you have the whole thing of like everyone finds out because of the flimsiest, someone just happened to be there to get the black box. Just this is shamefully shorthanded writing, and I expected better from the person at the helm of this, because if you're going to tell me the problem of, oh, you couldn't have a movie with this dark of an ending, did people not watch The Mist? Stephen King is not above having nihilistic endings, and especially with a movie that's trying to reflect modern times and a time where everyone's very divided and angry. You can't then say, oh, but we're going to give it a happy ending for a protagonist who is not political or seeing the big picture outside of his family. So to then try to retroactively tie everything together, I call 100% bullshit on.
What I also call 100% bullshit is Edgar Wright's explanation of this ending. At a screening of this, he did say that this was the planned ending from the beginning. And I am saying, I don't think the studio let him do the real ending. I think they had to kind of conjure up something like this to fucking placate. I can't feel like this is Edgar Wright's real ending. I can't.
I am going to say that I'll give at least something that, are we to believe the apostle?
It's the only version of the events we're given, but I think so.
But he's a YouTuber. Just because he's the apostle doesn't mean he's not part of manipulation just as much as anybody else.
I will call that out by saying the fact that we see Ben at a convenience store looking at his wife and daughter, I do believe the apostle, yes. I think this is how it ends. That's the only
I think it's supposed to be the apostle should be taken as scripture in the context of this movie, because that's like the message. And the movie is never really that ambiguous with a lot of what happens, either morally or within the game itself. So for that to be like the one, to then try to use that to explain an ambiguous ending, to try to like inceptionize it, or, you know, was it all in his head, or, you know, an ending like that where it's open-ended, you know, because like it reminds me so much of the, again, a lot of Philip K. Dick comparisons. There's that read on Total Recall that he actually dies in the chair, and everything that's happening is like, you know, in his head as he's dying. I would have respected an ending like that, where they fully committed, rather than the garbage we're exposed to. Oh my God, it's been a long time since I was this upset by a movie ending that was not written to be an actual twist. I thought they were above this.
That's so funny that you're saying you wanted an ending that's saying that this is all a dream, as opposed to actually
not a dream, but like the whole thing that like let's say they do the thing. I have to laugh when I say this. There's a South Park episode where Stan becomes a Pee Wee hockey coach. And he's doing it for this kid that's dying of cancer. They lose the game and the kid dies of cancer at the end, and the episode ends. I would have wanted something like that if you were going to be this dystopian. It just does not fit. And it feels, this ending feels like a literal deep fake that the studio mandated and manipulated in post-production.
Adam, be honest. Were my words kind of going through your head as you're seeing this plane kind of head to this building and them threatening to blow it up and all that? Like, did you think they would actually go that far?
I did, because I think Edgar Wright, you know what, I'll say this, and I know it's going to get into our finals. I think he signed on with the express authorization to do the ending. And then I think everything got fucked around at the end. I think he was given permission to do it, and I could see him signing on just because of that alone.
I think it's also a change maybe in his ideology. Maybe this was his call, because if you look at his Cornetto movies, two of the three don't really have happy endings. Like, the world still sucks in two of them. Mm-hmm. And if you look at post, like, Baby Driver and Soho have happy endings, quote unquote, despite all the horrible shit and the repercussions that should be there. Maybe he's just become less audacious since he's started making bigger movies, and he feels like he has to pull his punches as a result. Not to excuse it, but maybe that's the rationale, because I think there's a line of demarcation in his work where his endings become less cynical and more uplifting in a conventional Hollywood sense.
I kind of agree with that, because this is the biggest budget he's ever been given. So
and it will probably be the last ever big budget movie he makes.
Yeah.
He'll come to DC. James Gunn will call him. Question for both you. If it happens where we see the plane and then we see the apostle, and the apostle's like, hey, we found this and that, and then it ends with that. If it ends with ambiguity, do you like it better than us getting that final scene of proving that he lives and walks away?
I would say yes, because it could be that question, if you're the society, who do you put your faith in? The corporation that runs everything, or someone masquerading as a messiah and a prophet that also has the ability to manipulate? Like, you're picking the lesser of two evils. And I think that's a good message for a king property, especially for someone in King who's very critical of organized religion and people who use it to manipulate and justify bad things. So that would have felt more spiritually connected, if not. Even though it's not giving a direct resolution, I would have respected that.
Yeah, I'm with Matt on that. And to kind of piggyback on that, I will say that, you know, King did write this when he was a very young, very angry college student. And I want to clear up that I don't want the image of this plane flying into a building to be the thing that I wanted deeply in this movie. I don't. What I wanted was something, as Matt calls it, audacious. If they're going to blow the plane up, which, you know, we're told that they do until we're proven not, I could have gone with that. I could have gone with him being a messiah. I could have gone with him being a prophet in that way. But the fact that they pull their punches as they do, that's what pisses me off about this.
You also could have, like, if you want the happy ending, the middle ground you have is he dies, but Killian still upholds the deal and his daughter gets her treatment. Like, there's a million other things they could have done to appease or make a better compromise than what they do. Because instead of a compromise, it feels like a betrayal.
Adam, I'm getting from you that you like the way this ends.
Until that, I will say I like it better than both of you, I think. But I don't think that's saying a lot either. But I do. I could have used even more nihilistic, but yes.
All right, well, we're not at the very end yet, because Bobby says that Ben's a tough act to follow. And as Killian threatens Bobby, Bobby says to read his contract. As Killian takes the mic, we see a riot break out. Killian trips over a cord as Ben emerges from the fire and points a gun. He counts down to one and says action as he fires. And we see that Ben has won. As credits roll on 2025's The Running Man, boys. Wow. Much deeper discussion than I was expecting talking about The Running Man, but here we are. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Edgar Wright's 2025 version of The Running Man? Adam, go ahead, sir.
For a movie that I was initially excited about and then lost almost all interest in due to the marketing, missed in theaters, this movie is a misstep in a lot of ways. At the same time, it hits a lot of the beats, but then falls back into studio filmmaking and then jumps forward into Stephen King anger, nihilism, and then falls back into studio manipulation, let's call it. They might as well be the game show. It's inconsistent, and that hurts this movie so much. Glenn Powell, I don't know if he was the right choice. He's not a bad choice by the end of this, because I do think some of the dark moments that we see, that's what this movie is and should be. It's not the Arnold Schwarzenegger version. That movie's kind of a, as we mentioned at the outset of this, it's an American Gladiators bubblegum candy-coated version. From what I understand, the book is a lot more dark. This goes to that in some places, but not enough. This doesn't hit the balance. Edgar Wright should have been that balance, and this feels so much like a studio manipulation. But if he doesn't have the control, then that's on him. There's parts where I'm like, yes, this is what I hoped for. And then parts where I'm like, what the hell? How did we get here? Why are we skipping days? Why are we skipping weeks at a time? The ending, I think, is going to go where I want it. And then it pulls back because it doesn't have the cojones to follow through. The casting, I think, is pretty dang good, though. I appreciate that. We talk about, you know, the hosts of the show, and those really come through. But at the end of the day, this feels, it feels like it's missing something. It's missing the connective tissue. It's missing the run from beginning to end. It's better than advertised. It is, I think, considerably better than the advertising would make you think. But I think for the three of us who have gone through so many King's work and knows what he's capable of, that have watched Edgar Wright's movies and know what he's capable of, that's where this falls. This should have been a very good blend of both of their abilities. And because this thing is run through a wood chipper, it falls very flat because of that. I'm going to give it a 6. I think it's watchable. I think there's some good stuff in here. This could have been a great dark tale, especially in today's day and age, but it's not. So it's a 6 on 10. I think it's watchable, but I think you are going to miss so much of what this could have been.
All right. Wow. I was expecting a more positive review from you, actually, on that. 6 out of 10 from Mr. Bunch. Matt, go ahead.
You know, for a director that's been so remarkable with his music choices, I'm going to pull out my my album right here, because I want this movie to do like Toni Braxton said and unbreak my heart, because I feel like this was, I feel hurt. Like, I feel scorned by a lover watching this movie, because it does not, this thing should go to the dentist because it has no teeth. And I should check under its, check its extremities, because I don't think it has any balls either. Suffice it to say, I was not a fan of this movie. I wanted to love it. I think all the pieces were here. Glenn Powell's not a miscast, but I just don't think either he is given the full pathway to be a competent lead in this movie, and the script doesn't give him enough to play with beyond just the anger thing. And I find the compromises with the political angle and how his characterization kind of changes on a dime to be problematic. And for an Edgar Wright movie, this feels stripped of a lot of personality and a lot of integrity. And if this is what Ant-Man was going to be, maybe it was in his best interest that he left the project. So maybe the grass is greener on the other side. You know, for a movie called The Running Man, I could have gone up and taken a walk myself, because I didn't feel like I was missing a whole lot for chunks of this movie. I was kind of bored, and for an action movie, it doesn't hold up very well. And as a remake of something that was good for its time and I still really, really like, there was a clear justification to do this. And I think this was a squandered opportunity all around. There's a couple things I really like. The supporting cast, I think, really helps this work out. But a lot of this just feels underdeveloped, which is inexcusable for something that's almost 2.5 hours. You can't say lack of runway was a reason for this. I promise I'll stop using words that have the word run in it, everybody. But I don't feel like there were any excuses for this. We didn't hear a lot about studio meddling or rewrites. This thing only got delayed because of him working on other projects and the pandemic. So I don't want to hear anyone trying to explain, oh, this was, you know, a compromised vision or anything like that. This, you know, if he was going to be this upfront, put his name on it, and, you know, I'll rightfully praise all of his good movies, but I think this is the worst thing he's made, and I'm going to give it a 4 as a result.
Wow, 4 from Matt. You know, I tell you, when I initially heard that Edgar Wright was behind this, and I heard that the script was on the table and they were all set to run cameras on it, I didn't get too excited about it. I tell you what really amped up my excitement for this particular adaptation was last year's discussion that we had about the original. Because as much as we lavished it with some faint but very fun praise, 1987's The Running Man isn't a faithful adaptation of King's book at all. But what it is it's exactly what you think of when you think of Arnold Schwarzenegger at his absolute height. This could have been Edgar Wright at his absolute height. And the closer this got, I realized that, man, could this really be as good of a adaptation as I'm thinking it could be? And for the first 30 minutes or so, I was really with this film. I was really liking the setup. I was really liking what Edgar Wright was doing. Even if I wasn't a huge fan of Powell's anger issues, quote unquote, I was liking the nihilistic dystopian measures that were being taken with the opening setup to this film. As soon as the game started, as soon as it started feeling old hat, as soon as Edgar Wright kind of rested on his laurels and didn't really give me action scenes that propelled me like I know he can, I was feeling so bummed. And the longer the movie went, and God, is this movie too long, I was getting disenchanted with it. But as I said, will they do the nihilistic ending I'm expecting him to do? They don't. They pull their punches. As Matt said in his description, he lost his balls throughout the course of this film, and I really don't like how this film ends, and a film's ending is exactly what you come away from it, and that is your lasting impression on it. I was angry leaving that theater, and there was a reason why I kind of held off on us doing this review. It's because I wanted to give it another chance. I'm like, okay, let me watch it this week and see how I feel after some distance behind it. And as the huge King fan, as a huge fan of Edgar Wright, I was once again felt let down. So I'm with Matt. This is a 4 from me. And I hate the fact that I'm giving an Edgar Wright film a 4. I'm telling you guys right now, unless he comes out with another one that I don't like in the next set of years, until me and Matt and maybe Adam do a retrospective on his career, I will never give an Edgar Wright film a 4 again. But I felt this was just lacking in so many different things. And most of all, I just felt let down. My heart wasn't broken, as Matt explained. This isn't an Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny situation where I kind of came out of it with my head down, just completely pissed off and sad at what I just saw. But I still came out of this just feeling let down. And I hate feeling let down after an Edgar Wright film. So 4 out of 10 for The Running Man 2025. Boys, this is not the last time we are going to discuss King this year. We do have, oh boy, we have The Dark Tower coming up. We have different seasons. Shawshank, Apt Pupil, Stand By Me, which is going to be a first-time watch for Adam. So, guys, we're not done with King, are we, Matt?
We say that till we die.
I'm looking forward to Adam's first time viewing of Stand By Me. Adam, are you looking forward to that set of shows?
Sure. Look, I just saw Shawshank for the first time about 18 months ago, so I'm looking forward to finally discuss it. I know, people, which I know, okay, but I've heard about King since I was 15 years old, so I stayed away. Blame Garrett. Garrett, I think, remembers, like, I saw Apt Pupil in a movie theater. So of all the things we're going to discuss, that's the one that I actually saw.
Unbelievable.
Oh, fuck. I think we're going to have some great discussions. I really do.
Yeah, and speaking of great discussions, we're going to start some next week when we get to the Scream series. And I got to tell you guys, I just finished editing the first Scream show. Haven't done the second one yet, but I'm looking forward to those discussions, and I'm looking forward to people hearing the intro that me and Adam recorded a couple of weeks ago. I think that it is a different approach to introducing these podcasts, which I think people are going to really like. So I look forward to those shows. And of course, we have Black Phone 2 coming up. We have Avatar coming up. We are going to get to those eventually, probably in between the retrospective shows that we're doing. Thank God we have finally completed The Punisher, at least for now, but we are going to go back to Marvel. Stay tuned for what that is. But until next week, when we get to Scream 1, I'm still podcasting, you shit eaters.
Are you crazy? We don't have time to play games.
Oh, yes, we do. Fastest the hunters ever arrived on scene was 4 minutes, 30 seconds. We'll be long gone by then.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
That's game!
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Still there?
Yeah.
Come on.
That's for you.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
The audience lives for these happy accidents.
If you like this retrospective review, check out our archives at percolatedmedia.net, as we have tons of franchise reviews such as the Alien film series, the ongoing Marvel films, films of the DC universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Mission Impossible film series, the Exorcist films, the Jaws franchise, the Predator films, the Lethal Weapon films, the John Wick franchise, the Jurassic Park and Jurassic World film series, the Beetlejuice films, the Mad Max film series, the Megan films, Avatar, and so much more.
Why do you give a shit what I think?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
The
best audience in the world remains undefeated.
Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Shouldn't take long.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
My eye for talent remains unrivaled.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Not all accidents are happy.
Scheduling done by Matt.
Record, report, reward.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2026, and any and all music, movie, and sound clips are used for entertainment purposes and review only.
We here at The Running Man believe in following the rules. So it pains me to tell you that one of our most important rules has been broken by the very men we entrust to enforce them.
Had already been done. I feel like there have been better versions of the actual Running Man premise that this, I was worried, was going to be kind of outdated by the time it actually came out.
Yeah, you look at Squid Game 2, you know, that kind of took.
Yeah, that's a big one.
That's a big one. But you know what?
Exactly.
Well, go ahead, Adam.
You hit what I was going to say. The phenomenon of Squid Game.
And Scott Pilgrim, the writer of the comic, whose name I'm blanking on, what's his fucking name? Adam, help me. Brian O'Malley?
Yes. The writer of the comic. Yeah.
Brian Lee O'Malley was heavily involved. He was heavily involved in the production of that movie.
Yeah.
Didn't they make this joke in Hitman with his disguises and falling off? I mean, I can't believe you literally did the same thing.
Because that plays to Glenn Campbell's strengths, is he's good at doing these disguise type films. You know, Glenn Powell. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't know if we were, you know, discussing the Eagles. Don't.
That's right. All right, I'll say that line again. So, this plays to Glenn Powell's strengths is. Ben says that he doesn't get why they're not turning him in, and he's told that he can get taken to Boston if he wants, and who the hell wants to go there? Am I right, guys? Wow, that line landed with a thud. Okay, moving on. Ben says that he's just...
No, because Bradley sends him there.
Then that's on me because I missed it. All right, and then I feel better about it.
And in this book written in 1972, that was in it, was Derry.
Oh, Derry.
Yeah, apparently then Stephen King needs to develop a lactose tolerance because I'm so sick of this goddamn town.
Ben's taken into...
But do this in a way like Demolition Man did. Really revel in it.
Yeah.
You're a TV show. Find a way just that... the product placement, you could have just gone, I don't know, Demolition Man. Like, it's the best way I could think of it.
Yeah, there literally should have been in a dystopian future where the network rules everything. Why is there not like a billboard like in the original every 5 seconds or the show like commercials in between? Domingo should be wearing logos on his jacket like a NASCAR racer.
Where's Nuke Cola when you need it?
By the way, we are getting a Demolition Man sequel pretty soon, so stay tuned for that retrospective.
Yeah, good luck getting Sandra Bullock to come back.
Yeah, right. I like these symbols. A fight breaks out as Elton slices McCone's heel gate. I'm sorry. As Elton slices McCone's heel. Money falling all around as Bobby proclaims America. I'm sorry. Money's falling all around Bobby as he